Today on the podcast, Sam and I have a chance to speak with the lovely Maddie McLean, a psychologist who works predominantly with kids alongside her therapy dog, Maple, in private practice. We explore and discuss animal-assisted activities that can be incorporated into therapy sessions and the challenges and joys that go along with that. I'll also note that there is a slight abrupt ending to this episode because we did go over time, but let's get into it. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode with Therapy Dogs Australia on the podcast. Sam and I are joined today by Maddie McLean. Hi, Maddie.
Hello.
Hi. So I'm going to we'll hand it over to you to introduce yourself to the audience.
Yeah, cool. So I am a registered psychologist. I did my 4+2 pathway, so it doesn't exist anymore, unfortunately. But instead of doing your master's pathway, you do 2 years of supervised practice and learn all your competencies in the work that you do, which is quite cool, and I've enjoyed doing that. I work in Northern New South Wales, predominantly with kids, I'd say from like 4 years old up until some 20-year-olds and things like that too. This is my room here. I have 2 dogs. They're both American Staffies, but the one that I work with, her name's Maple. She's 4 years old. I originally got her as a pet dog, so I didn't really select her in any special way. She was just very cute and looked like my other dog, and I was like, I need another one of these. She's so cute.
She is so cute.
She's so cute. And I guess when we were walking her along the footpath and stuff along the Cromer beachfront, I noticed she'd be drawn to kids and kind of pulled towards playgrounds and kids walking past, and I was like, how can I mix my love of dogs and like what I've worked so hard in psychology for and do both at once? Because I don't know, a long time at uni, so just want to like throw the psych pathway away altogether. And I'd heard of therapy dogs, but I wasn't too sure about what the training involved or who did it or whatever else. Quick Google search, Therapy Dogs Australia came up. At the time, I think it was COVID, so the training program was all online, but it was like a week intensive course, and then we were actually able to go up to Sam's property and do the assessment in person, which was quite fun as well to meet everyone that we'd done the course with. So that's how I kind of came about it. That was 3 years ago, I think, because I did it when Maple was about 9 months old.
Time flies, goodness.
Yeah, and then did the learning, the learners, because she was under the age of one. And then, yeah, it's kind of have been lucky enough to have a workplace that wants her whenever I want to bring her in. All the kids love her. She's on the website. She's like a little, like, people call up and they're like, so how can we see Maple?
Yeah, I'd like to book in with Maple, please.
Yeah, I'm like, hello, it's me. Or like we get referrals from some GPs that say Maddie and Maple at the top. It's
so I cute. Love when they do that. So cute.
So adorable. Nice. So yeah, like I've really loved it because obviously I get to hang out with my dog as well as do the work that I like to do, and just seeing the way that a dog can enhance the intervention that we provide is really cool to have done that. So yeah, it's already been 3 years of having her trained with Therapy Dogs Australia.
Three great years. So who's your client demographic, Maddie? And you're in private practice?
Yeah, private practice, a mixture of NDIS clients as well as Medicare and private paying clients. A lot of ADHD, ASD, anxiety, depression. I don't work without mood or personality disorders or anything like that, because we are working with little ones anyway. But yeah, predominantly a lot of ASD kids, a lot of ADHD. And I would go to do school visits and stuff like that, but Maple's just an in-office dog.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a lot easier that way, isn't it?
Yeah. Some parents ask if she can go to schools, and I say, she could if I do a lot of extra procedures and processes around that. But for what it's worth, it's a lot easier to just get the parents and kids to come in here. And
yeah.
And I know that the type of dog she is, a school would be like a bit overwhelming and overloaded for her. So I think she's better in this environment than taking her somewhere like that.
Especially like for one, like to visit one kid as well, yeah. Because you got to get past 600 other kids to get to that one kid too.
Yes. Like, yeah. Yeah, I was like, it's just not really that practical. And then people are happy to hear that answer, and then they just bring their child in anyway. And like I said, everyone wants to see Maple and whether I'm here or not. A bonus.
Amazing. How did you find the training, Maddie? Like, so Maple was 9 months, was she?
Yeah, she was 9 months old. Yeah. I found that she, in general, was a good dog in terms of obedience and things like that. She was quite easy to train, eager to please, unlike my other dog who was a bit the opposite, very stubborn. But I feel like because he's 5 years older than her, so she was a puppy, he was five, I think she matured a lot quicker because of how he is with her. So she had that in-home kind of being put in her place and having to listen. The course is really great. I found the actual clinical, because I did the clinical course, that content really interesting in terms of the theories behind it, the evidence behind it, why it's important, and it's not just bringing your dog to work, because some people do that, and I've worked with someone that did bring their dog to work that was not trained in any way, and they just don't have that understanding of why it's important, why training is important, why understanding the theories and concepts around it are so important before just being like, oh, my dog likes kids and they love me and they're a good dog,
that's,
and they're cute, so I'll bring them in. So I found the course really good for that. And then obviously going away and doing my own obedience as well as having to pass the obedience side of things, that was quite easy because she was easy to train. But I guess it was just like working on her confidence and things like recall or the boundary setting and what is it? The
impulse control.
Impulse control. At the start, I was like, this dog has no impulse control at all. But now, like, yeah, tone of voice, both my dogs, tone of voice has been so great to implement in that way, because then you're not just like yelling at your dog or saying the word over and over again. It's like you can say one thing in a certain way and then they're immediately like, I know what to do. So like the course was probably set up a bit differently because it was the week intensive.
Back in when we first transitioned to online because of COVID, we were still doing that last day assessment as a group, because we because we were still allowed to have gatherings of X amount of people outdoors, like with the COVID rules. We're in Queensland, so I think we didn't get quite as much restrictions, but we were doing, so we'd do like the five, it was 6 days back then too. It was 5 days online with like Zoom stuff, and then it was the Saturday we did the assessments, because we used to do the course like 5 days, 6 days, like face to face, like a boot camp. And then and it was great. Like, we loved it, but it was harder. Because there's so much theory. Like, it's all theory. There's a huge amount of theory. And then so you're trying to take in all this theory, and then, but your dog is there with you the whole time. We tried using crates for our first course, but the dogs weren't crate trained, so that it was just chaos. So then we're like, okay, people can just have their dogs like on lead with them in the like classroom, which was fine, but it's also distracting. So we only went online, because of COVID. And so then we were like, in that, it was like a little trial. And I was like, it's so much easier for people to pay attention to what we're saying and the lecture content and do their worksheets and stuff, because their dogs are just like at home with them, like sleeping at their feet, or they're at home while the person's at work doing the course or whatever. But we were doing that, still doing that last day of assessments, because that was heaps easier for us. We could just get through all the assessments. But it just turned out, like, so for international, the restrictions got more strict. And then the interstate people couldn't do it, obviously. So then we're like, oh, okay, well, what do we do now? So, yeah, we just had to change it to locum dog trainers and video assessments. So here we are.
Yeah, but I think it's cool too, because then anyone around Australia can do it without having to access you guys in Brisbane and having to be within a certain distance. Because I'm on Goldie, and I think on that day it took 2 hours to get up there, and Mabel was already a bit out of sorts by the time I got up there. She was like slept the whole way, and then she was like, "Where am I?"
Yeah,
with all these like random dog smells, different environment. She was like, "What?"
It's really not ideal assessment conditions.
No.
And we didn't need the dogs to be able to cope with that. Like, we needed them to be able to cope with what their workplace was going to require of them. But also the humans didn't really cope with it that well either. Like, there was far more humans that got overwhelmed with the stress because they were thinking, like, this is my only chance, you know, like, so they get overwhelmed. And there was, multiple times that we had people that got upset because their dogs didn't pass on the day. But it just is what it is, that all the dogs are at a different pace. So it just is what it is. And then when we went to, like, so that's why Maple was the learner, because we used to assess dogs under 12 months and give them learners. Whereas now I'm like, oh, your dog's close enough to 12 months. You can do an assessment now and be a learner, or you can just wait to submit your assessments until they're 12 months old, and then you don't have to do it again to get at 12 months. Because it's a fair bit of work doing the videos and stuff. But now people get to go at their own pace. It's at their dog's pace and their pace. And then the assessment itself, because it used to just be all in one day, that's a lot for the dogs. Like, we had to do the temperament and all the obedience stuff. It's a fair bit for the dogs. So it's now that they can do it over time, I think it gives us a better idea of the dogs, actually, you know?
Yeah. And I find too, obviously, because you can film the different obedience tasks over weeks if you wanted to. I don't know, like, on some days she might not listen to me, and then I'm like, if that was the day that I was doing her recall, I would fail. But the next day she could be really great, but I've missed my one chance to do it. So I found the videoing a lot better in that sense. I'd still record it all in the one go, but it was easier without having to have, like, the travel and, like you said, the pressure on the humans. Like, I remember driving up there being like, what if I don't pass? Like, anxious about it. And then, but the whole thing is, like, if you then pass on your anxiety to the dog, then they'll also know that something's going on.
Yeah.
You know, we will fail. So I was like, act calm.
Literally. I am calm.
We're so calm
I'm calm right now.
Yeah.
And then we had them scheduled too, so you couldn't just reassess whenever you wanted. Whereas when someone fails an assessment now, the dog's just had a shit day, or they've had a shit day, or whatever, they can just book it for literally the next week if they want to. Like, if it's just one of those things, like, we've talked about that on podcast before about past failing assessments, and it's like, okay, so maybe the dog's not ready and you need to do a bit more work, or maybe it just went to shit on the day. Whereas back then we only had certain days scheduled, so you'd have to wait a few months or whatever. So people were freaking out. It really wasn't ideal.
COVID changed a few things, and obviously this is one of those things that changed for the better for everyone.
Learning exercise and trial for us to just be pushed into. And then now, like you say, so, like, we, one of our things as well is, like, trying to increase accessibility so that people interstate and that can, because people in WA and Northern Territory and that, they don't have options for therapy dog training. So having our course online has made those people able to do it, which means that we've got less dogs being taken into the workplace without any training of the dog and or handler. So I think that's enough of a reason for us to keep doing it online, even though people ask us to do it face-to-face all the time. They just don't know. I know it seems like it would be better face to face, but they just don't know what that was actually like. Like, there was, like, multiple occasions when people were in tears, like, just having total breakdowns over the stress of the situation. Or, like, some people, when they get stressed like that, become antisocial. So Jess and I used to cop a fair bit of shit. Like, we'd be like, okay, everything's going to be fine. Like, calm down. Yeah, so I do appreciate not having quite so much of that these days as well, because people can do it. It's just not such a pressure cooker situation. Like, you know, so, and when people submit their videos, they watch them back first. So they mark them themselves to improve that self-evaluation stuff. So if they watch them back and they genuinely think like, this is great, and it's not, then we can be like, oh, okay, so we've got a gap in our communication here. So we can address, yeah, like, you know, but usually people just take their time. And then when they submit their video, it's like, not that, it's not very often that we, not very often at all that we fail videos. And I think it's because of that. Like, we used to have to fail people in their obedience all the time. But now, like, I think because, well, and, you know, we do understand as well that people can film it 100 times and send through the best one. I am aware of that. But at the same time, we ask people to be honest in their representation of their dogs. So, you know,
there is a level of, you know, personal accountability anyway, that 100%. Goes into it. Like, you know, you, yeah, can do that if you want, but
yeah, that's what I tell people.
Taking, yeah, the dog.
Yeah. We've actually got paperwork that people sign when they submit their assessments, and it explains that in the paperwork of like, so you're actually responsible for your dog and yourself. Like, we're not responsible for you. So you actually maintain responsibility for yourself. So it's in your best interest to represent yourself truthfully, yeah, so that we can give you proper advice and feedback. Like, it's actually not wise to misrepresent yourself, because if you end up in the shit down the track, like, that's still going to come back on you. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't really, it's not really that helpful for you long term.
Yeah, for sure.
How did you find, Maddie, when you started, when once Maple had passed, how was like those first few sessions like at work with Maple? How did that feel? How did that go?
I think I was still a bit nervous, obviously, because I hadn't done it yet. And I know that all the theory and stuff sounds great. And I looked at all the stuff that I could do, and I was like, oh, I can't wait to do these things with her. And then obviously I think I started this role after I'd done the course as well. So I hadn't actually got this role yet. And so I was like, oh, well, I need to learn this role before I bring her in. So I didn't bring her in for a little while because I wanted to get my feet working with kids, working in this office, doing all those kinds of things.
You're still provisional, weren't you?
I was provisional too. So yeah. I was like, there's a lot going on, and I was trying to like finish up everything. So I was like, there's no point in trying to do everything at once. She also had an awful accident where she jumped out a car window driving, and then got lost in the Crumbin Valley for the entire day.
Oh gosh, what a stressful
and so I thought event. She was dead. A very big day.
I already know this story, so I'm not
very long day. And that happened after she'd passed the assessment. So like,
yeah,
she passed this assessment, and then this happened, and then she was like this ball of anxiety that like,
yeah, it was like traumatized.
No one touched her, no one come near her, like triggered by everything. So then obviously I didn't bring her in for that reason, because I was like, there's no point in bringing her in, because these kids will come near her, she'll be scared, she'll hate this place, the kids will be like, this dog's not even friendly, why is she here?
And she was so obviously unhappy about,
yeah, she was unhappy about everything. So then I worked on kind of rebuilding her confidence, just like doing, I don't know, all the obedience stuff to prove to her that like she can do stuff still.
Oh, bless her.
And I think it wasn't until that happened in the December, I don't think I brought her into work until like the Feb of the next year or something. So like a month or two. And then started her off on really low hours and days. I think to start it was like half a day a week, just because I knew that that would be her limit. But I found one of the first boys that she worked with was a 5-year-old on the spectrum, and he never came in without his mom. And then I was like, oh, I'll try bringing Maple in. Like, let's see how we go. We put some bubbles for her. I found out she really likes eating bubbles. And then all of a sudden, like, this kid's blowing bubbles for her for like 20 minutes straight.
Aww.
And then the mum's left the room. And then from that time onward, he stayed in on his own. And so, like, that was her first relationship here. And I still remember that because that was really cool for me. Because I was like, wow, if I didn't have her, how long would it have taken me to be able to have the mum be able to wait in the waiting room without having her in there?
And you would have had to jump around and bite all the bubbles yourself. So,
right.
Which and is unprofessional, to say the least.
Tastes like soap. So, like, I reckon that was one of, like, my first times where I was like, obviously I know the benefit, but then I saw it myself and I was like, this is really cool. And I can't wait to, like, see more of those moments where every time the kid comes in, they're like, where's Mabel? Can't wait to see her, like, buy her Christmas presents, like, all sorts of things. It's just so cute. Like, we went to Pet Barn on the way here. I was like, oh, what did you get her?
Quite cute, eh?
Really cute. Quite cute. So, yeah, I think it took me a while to build my confidence with managing everything. But I found having a crate really helpful because if the environment got too much for everyone, like, the child wasn't participating or engaging because all they wanted to do was play with Maple, I could kind of say, like, oh, she needs a rest. Like, we'll do an activity and then we can get her out later. For some things, and I feel like having the crate with a door on it that she can kind of, like, walk in herself shows the child, like, she needs a break. That's her safe space. Like, we're not going to go in there and annoy her. And if she comes back out, great. But if she doesn't, that's fine too. Like, she might just want to have a rest in there. The crate's good. It just gives her, like, a zone where they can't go towards her.
Yeah.
Especially at the end of the day, like, she's just trashed. And so she might stay in there the whole last session of the day, which some kids are like, oh, why is she tired? I'm like, well, she's been here all day.
Yeah.
She's exhausted. And I don't make her come out for that because I'm like, if she doesn't want to, she doesn't want to.
So how do you handle that in terms of relationship for the kids? Like, if they've been excited, because it's like you say, like, it's this big impact of, you know, we're kind of manipulating and making use of this relationship with the dog to where it benefits us by being like, oh, now my job's easier because I've got this kid who wants to blow bubbles for the dog and he can, you know, but that's hit that kid's relationship with the dog. That's,
yeah,
that whether we're then like piggybacking off that and going, yeah, great, now I'm part of that. So what do you do? How do you maintain or protect, you know, feelings of rejection or things like that in that relationship when obviously the kids are bonded to the dog? So if they rock up and the dog is not interested in them, how do you manage that?
I find it, like, I know how at the start when we did the course, it was like the 2 hours to 2 days a week type rule around, like, working the dog and things like that. So I guess I find more so, like, being able to pace her throughout the day and making sure she doesn't sort of burn out towards the end of the day. Like, I know she's 4, so she's not like a puppy anymore and she's not old, but I swear, like, working in here is the most tired she gets ever. Like, I could take her for a run and she doesn't get as tired as working. Which is, yeah, like, when I see it, I'm like, how is this so different to Shark? And she could run for like 4 hours at the beach and probably come home and not be as tired. So I've learned to, like, pace her for certain days where I'm like, my 4 p.m. is going to want to have to play with you. And if they're going to come in and you're going to be asleep this whole day, like, that will be unfair for them because they're looking forward to it. And it's almost me knowing, like, all right, well, I'll use it for the first 10 minutes of this session, but then, like, you need to have a rest rather than doing bubbles for, like, however long at the start of the day, being like, well, I know the little guy at 3 p.m. really wants to blow bubbles for you. So, like, maybe you rest, or, like, I live 15 minutes from home. So sometimes I just, like, go get her for a half day. So I either pick her up or drop her off, 'cause I just know that her stamina for a full day isn't there. And even if she is only spending 5-10 minutes of a session, I feel like her rest and her sleep isn't restful compared to what sleep she's getting at home.
Yeah.
Because whatever, like, she's still ready to hear the treat packet open, the bubble container open, like, she's ready. And so and even letting the kids know, like, oh, she's been here since 8 a.m. this morning. Are you really tired after school? And kind of making it relatable and knowing that it's nothing that you've done. Like, are you really tired at the end of a big day?
Mm.
And you're like, I'm so tired, like I need a nap. And I'm like, oh, well, that's why she's having a nap. But then also knowing there's those few things that kind of bring her up and out of being tied in her crate, like the bubbles, like the treats. I've got like treat puzzles that I do with the kids and things like that. As soon as you get them, she's like up and ready to go.
Yeah.
And we do like Maple's engine speeds and things like that, and like how to get her out of her slow speed, because all the kids are like, she's so slow. And I'm like, yeah, she's often very slow in here because she's tired. But then those few things that, or like her ball, she loves her ball. So there's like a few things that I know can get her up and about.
Yeah.
And those kids know that. So they're like, oh, let's do some bubbles. And then teaching them that maybe when their speeds are at different levels, like what can they do, and relating that back to them is something that I like to do.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is hard when kids are like, why is she in there? Why is she so tired all the time? It's like, well, yeah, it's not you. It's 4 o'clock. She's been here for 8 hours already today, and kind of talking it like that.
Yeah.
But then also knowing that she can't do consecutive days. She can't. Sometimes it's only like once a week, or even sometimes if I can tell she's not in a good mood that morning, I just don't take her at all.
Yeah.
Because I know that that's better than having the kids feel rejected.
Yeah,
I would
yeah,
just say like, yeah, oh, she's at home, she's tired today.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think, you know, using all that, you know, positive language and stuff, because sometimes when this topic comes up, people say, oh, it's, you know, it's just doesn't matter because it's the dog's tired, which I think, like, I understand that, but I've also got the dog here and I'm dealing with an emotionally vulnerable child, and that my job is to support the child, and the dog's assisting in that where possible. So if I've got the dog and I'm like, oh well, the dog's tired, so too bad, kid, I don't think that's conducive to doing a good job as a psychologist. I think that there's lots of ways to get around it. And Nala's really similar. She, all the dogs, like most people that we speak to, like all my dogs have been like this anyway, but they get really excited for the first maybe 2 to 5 minutes that someone rocks up for their appointment. Their favorite thing is to run out into the hallway, into the waiting room, and be like, who is here? And Oliver's a herding dog, so he's like, follow me, please. Back into the room. Yes, let's go. And he gets really excited and like jumps up really, like he really loves to work the waiting room. It's his favorite thing. And yeah, but Nala goes, so Oliver has his favorite spot under my pot plant, and Nala sleeps under my chair, and they're in their spots pretty quick. Like it's, it doesn't last long that they've got that excitement going on. If the person that's who's having the session, if they keep the dog going, like they find a way to interact with the dog that keeps the dog like going, then the dog will last longer. But generally speaking, because my clients are regulars, but generally speaking, they do the greeting and then they'll either go into their spots or they might fall asleep on the couch. But I've got a few ways that I can re-engage the dog again, which is pretty much exactly what Maddie's describing, the same stuff. But I think it's important, if it is therapeutically beneficial for the client to experience. So a lot of my kids, I'm teaching social skills. So it is actually useful for them to have that theory of mind, and about, because we're dealing with friendships and sibling relationships and parent relationships all the time, where we do actually have to learn to understand that the other person in the relationship has got their own needs and things like that. So I don't mind explaining, like, oh, you know, like it's already 4 o'clock in the afternoon, like she's been here all day, she's sleepy, but why don't, you know, and then using that really positive repairing sort of language around, so always keeping it positive, like it's, yeah, like Maddie's saying, like it's not So she just doesn't like you. But it's, and it's not being, I don't think we need to be overprotective of the dogs either. If you're feeling like you have to be overprotective of your dog and be like, oh no, no one can interact with her for the rest of the day because she's tired. She probably should be doing half days, or, you know, looking at how well suited the dog is to the job, because it's not that hard to re-engage the dog again, and you can do it for short periods of time. And then what we can do in the meantime is all of our interventions and stuff that revolve around the dog, but the dog doesn't have to physically be doing anything.
Yeah. I find too, like you said, the sibling relationships and things like that, it's good having another dog and it being like a boy girl and having the age gap and saying, oh, Maple's the annoying little sister and Ollie's the big brother that, and she annoys him, and how do you think that feels? And sometimes I have to put her in her place away from him because he gets really annoyed by her, blah blah blah. And them understanding that is really good, because then it takes away from, oh, I'm the annoying little sister, or I'm the one that kind of snaps back, all that narrative social story type stuff that you can do. And the kids have never met Ollie, but so many of them are like, when can he come in? Can he come in?
Yeah.
I'll show you photos and videos, but he's never coming in. Like, he would love it and he would bring a whole different energy, but I also know he's a jumper. He's not great at listening if he doesn't want to listen. So I'm like, around little children, bad idea. Yeah. They're like, you should bring them both in together. And I was like, terrible idea. They wrestle like they're big dogs.
Yeah. Used to take two dogs to work all the time, and I look back at that now and I'm like, why did I do that to myself? No. It's so good though. There's all those interactions that the dogs have. It's awesome. It's,
yeah,
but it I is think a lot of work.
Touching on like the fact that you can talk about Maple and Ollie while they don't even have to be there, I think is really special as well. Like, when people say that, you know, with therapy dogs, they have to be in the room or you have to be doing XYZ, but like, there's a whole world of things that you can do in the session with the kids, clearly, where the dog doesn't even have to be present for it to have an impact on the kid. And like, when it comes to, you know, your dog feeling tired and not, you know, necessarily feeling like they're best suited to be in the session because of XYZ, it's really wonderful that they can still be a part of that, even if they have to be home for the day, or, you know, they're having an off day in the morning, that they're still like having an impact.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's, it's really cool. It's really special.
Yeah, I find, because I have like posters like here, I have like Maple's engine with pictures of her, and I have like the zones with pictures of her. And some kids, like you said, don't get to meet her for whatever day, like it's for whatever reason, because it's not her day, or I just don't think that the session would be right for either of them to get what we need to get out of it. I still use the posters, and they look at photos and videos, and it's like they know her and they'll ask about her, and it's cool, because I don't think they necessarily care if they never meet her either, because it's almost like they know her. And some of them seem to like Ollie more by what I describe of both of them.
That's cute. So
it's actually good not having to have her and need her here for what the purpose of it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah. I brought this up with someone the other day, but I don't remember who it was, where the topic came up again about like dependency on the dog. So I'm a really big advocate for utilizing the dog as much as possible and as is useful early on in the therapeutic relationship, but then the role of the dog should become less important, and we should be transferring that rapport and that onto us as the therapist, because we're the one that is going to be delivering all this information and blah de blah. But then even as a therapist, like codependency on a therapist is not appropriate either. So, and even though that happens and people really become very reliant on, you know, needing therapy and needing, you know, that relationship, our ultimate goal is for people to not need it. So if you enjoy therapy and you want to continue to engage because you want to have an hour to talk about yourself without feeling selfish, that's fine with your friends. But in terms of, you know, our ultimate outcomes will be that you don't need us. So, you know, throughout the course of what you've been learning and working on in therapy, you've been able to strengthen your support network and your other social relationships and your other supports, so that, you know, you don't just become over dependent on one support. It's exactly the same with the dogs, because we don't want actually for that relationship with the dog to become something that can then be it can be quite traumatic in having an transition out of that relationship down the track. And it's not their dog, and they're not guaranteed access to this dog forever, or for some kids for even a very long time. So I think it's important to keep that in mind as well, that we absolutely are gonna the bond that they develop with the dog is so beautiful, and it's so helpful, and it's so healthy. But to keep it that way, I think, is to not over rely on it as well. But to have that natural sort of transition out of the relationship that we can help with guiding. But then to have that be more of a stepping stone. The relationship with this, you know, your therapist dog is a stepping stone in you building these skills and working on whatever you need to work on, to then be able to have relationships with the therapist, and then better relationships with your parents and your siblings and your friends and your teachers and whatever. Because then your network just grows so much. If we don't have that line of sight about moving, you know, I don't want you to need this forever. Dogs die. People change jobs. Dogs, stuff happens. And then all of us, dogs get injured. All of a sudden the dog's not a part of the plan anymore. I think this is especially important in schools too, where I've heard a few cases of like some kids that have become really super dependent on the relationship with the dog at the school. And I think, okay, great, but remember that this is a stepping stone. It's a stepping stone, and the job of the support person who's working with the dog, who's the handler, is for you to develop the relationship with the kid. And then you as a support person, you bring someone else into that kid's circle as well, bring another support person into their circle too, and help facilitate the relationship there, because there are days the dog's not going to be there. There are days when that one support person's not going to be there. And then what we've got is we've set up a situation where a vulnerable person has got one method of support, one safe space. And if we just leave it at that, then what about when you're not there? I think that's a lot of responsibility as well as the support provider, to be the only person who can, you know, I've got to take the dog, and I've got to be there, and that sort of thing, because this person is completely reliant on it. Whereas, I don't know if you've felt this before, Maddie, but it feels pretty good to be like the one person that this little person will talk to, or the one person that this, you know, very shut off little person will, tell anything to or interact with or feel supported by. Kind of like when my first Brumby, but I gentled, like, she was like, I'll kill everyone that's not you. And I was like,
I'm special.
You know what? I feel great about that. That's actually.
Yeah. Boss whisperer.
I feel like the chosen one, and it feels pretty great. It's a nice feeling, but it's not good for the Brumby. Like,
yeah. And I had that with clients that get very attached, and then it's obviously so nice that they have that strong attachment to you, but, you know, for whatever reason, the frequency of sessions has to drop because they don't need to come weekly anymore, or they're moving away, or like
funding issues.
Yeah, just anything. And then you know that when that happens, it's going to, like, their little world's going to crumble.
Yeah.
And that's really hard. But I found, like, when I see the dependency starting with Maple, almost maybe having those days that the kid comes in maybe for a week, not bring her in that day and just say, yeah, oh, sorry, like, because she does get itchy paws. She's allergic to everything, this dog. So right. Sometimes, yeah, a lot of money and no cure. But I would say, like, oh, she had really itchy paws this morning. She had to be at home. And then they have to learn that their session could continue. And we do the same things, just without blowing bubbles and feeding dog treats. We still do the same thing. And I find after doing that sporadically, I guess to the point where, like, they don't walk in straight away and they're like, where is she? They'll actually talk to me first and interact a little bit more. And then when she is here, it's not straight to her being like, what can we do with her first? They go, oh, hey, Maple. And then we talk about whatever. And then I say, how about we do this with her? And it's not so much that straight away she's their world. And then
the
I'm
intensity,
just an accessory on the side.
Yeah. Yeah. I found that over time too. Like, it's hard for me to relate sometimes because my dogs have not had to work very hard for quite a while because my caseload has been, ever since the NDIS came in, I've got a lot of kids that I've had for a long time and I haven't taken on a lot of new clients. But definitely back in the day, my dogs were absolutely pivotal in these kids' engagement and disclosure and their learnings and the sessions. And I just couldn't even imagine doing my job without them. Once you've worked with them and everything's like better and easier. But then, yeah, over time, like the kids aren't needing, they just don't need the dog as much. They love that the dogs are there or they love that the horses are there, but they don't actually need them. And I think that's really important. And I need, you know, they need to not need me too eventually. Mm. Well, like, you know, it's same, like, you know, for clinicians that are listening, it's the same as, well, we want to get to the point where the clients, they don't, you know, they might need a weekly appointment to start with, but then we want to get them to a fortnightly appointment and then a monthly appointment. And then, you know, end the treatment episode if they are doing well and they can re-engage at a later time if things go pear-shaped. But it's like frowned upon. I know working with neurodivergent populations is a little bit different because it's a lifelong issue. And so my kids that I've seen for a while, they've got different issues popping up, like their developmental issues. So they're as they move through different developmental stages in their life, the challenges are different. So yeah, we had these challenges in primary school, but now we're in high school and the challenges are now, you know, dating and puberty stuff and things like that's totally different to what we were working on when they're in primary school. And now they're in the workforce and it's like totally different again, like entering the workforce. I've got some that are entering the workforce at the moment. Lordy Lord. I'm like, this is like completely different set of social skills that are required. It's a real reality check in a lot of ways to be emotionally supported through. But yeah, so we want to be able to reduce that dependency everywhere we can along every step of the way. I just want to remind people that therapy animals is no different. It's no different at all. I especially think of schools where it's like 1,000 kids that of all these kids, how many are relying on this dog for whatever? And then the dog gets sick or the person changes school. Like there's a lot of moving around. So the person changes schools or whatever, or the dog has an issue of some sort and they're just not there anymore. I think that's got a lot of potential to be pretty traumatic.
I found it kind of good in a way that, like, when I was coming up to my maternity leave, having to get all the clients ready to be going to different clinicians or having a break, and then coming back from maternity leave, almost being able to start fresh with the expectations around, I don't know, like, I haven't had that same obsession with her that I had when I first started bringing her in because I'm a bit more aware of how to manage it from the outset, and not have like, oh yeah, every single appointment that you're coming to, she'll be here. And be like, oh, well, I only work 3 days a week now. I don't know when I'll bring her in. If she's here when you come in, great. If she's not, maybe next time.
Yeah.
And I found kids are so much better with that because they don't come in. They kind of go, oh, is she here today? And I can be like, oh, sorry, she's not here today. And they go, oh, bummer.
Yeah.
But they are still happy to be here and they come do the session and they leave fine. Whereas I reckon at the start, when she was first developing those really strong relationships, I could say I'd have to almost message the parent in the morning being like, can you please tell them she's not going to be here today? Whereas now I don't have to do that to anyone, which is a good feeling.
Yeah. It is, isn't it? Yeah. I think that to cover like all bases here, that there are clients who, I think I've said this before, there are clients who I would prefer to cancel their appointment than cancel the dog or the horse.
Yeah.
Because we're not at that point. We're just not at that point where there's any engagement. But I've had clients who like super, super difficult, and it actually hasn't taken that long to get the dependence. Like I'm absolutely using the dependence on the animal and the relationship with the animal early on. That's why the animal's here. That's why I have all these flipping animals, like, and all these flipping vet bills. Yeah. Like, you know, I'm absolutely doing that. Actually, I can think of one at the moment who, so difficult, such a difficult, difficult little person. Anyway, so I got the goats, and this kid like loves goats. I didn't even know that. This kid loves goats. And so anyway, we've been spending time with the goats. But from that, and he's like obsessed, right? And, you know, we're giving the goats special yummy things to eat and stuff. From that, I don't know, like he just likes me now better, I think. Like, because
he's the goat lady.
He was hard, man. Like one of those really tricky, all the sort of behavioral disorders sort of group of stuff going on there. I'm just trying to be really vague, but yeah. Just very behavioral kid. Really like quite young, primary school, and just tricky. Like one of the only kids that's thrown rocks at me. Usually I can like talk them off that ledge. Not this one. Like it's like I'm throwing these rocks at you. So he throws rocks at everyone. So the goats, right? So I'm like, oh my God, like this kid likes the goats. Turns out it's like one animal. He's like scared of other animals and stuff, like really easily overwhelmed, like likes animals, but he's like really easily overwhelmed. Loves these goats. Great. So we've spent time with the goats. Now, like he doesn't even, like he likes, like where you rock up here, you can see the goats are like right in the front area. Like, so you can like see them straight away. He doesn't even need to go in there. He wants to hang out like with me and his mum and do all this, like all sorts of stuff. Like, and, but he's just so happy. And I'm like, this kid's like way more pleasant to deal with. And it means that our, like, he doesn't need all these animals anymore. And I tried a lot with the dogs, tried a lot with the horses, tried no animals, but for whatever reason, I don't know, like,
He's got the goats,
but now he doesn't even want to go in the goat paddock. Like he's happy to just like look at them from outside and then, yeah, keep hang out with me and his mum and talk about stuff that's been going on and all these things, which I just think, wow, like it's pretty, because I was thinking I'm going to be spending every session for the rest of this kid's life with these goats because you know, it doesn't throw rocks at me in there. So I'm like, this is
good. Yeah, the place I'm safe.
This is great. But yeah, isn't that interesting?
That's fascinating.
Yeah, goats over horses and dogs.
Yeah.
How long was that? Like you said, it was quite a fast, you know, transition where your relationship improved. Like was
a
it
few
like the
sessions?
Yeah,
like
wow.
Just a few sessions, but I've known this kid for years.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
I've
okay.
Known this, and this was a kid that came from another therapist, was with another clinician at Paw, who Amy, who moved on, And yeah, years, years.
How interesting.
Isn't that interesting? I don't know what's going on with that, but
magic
it's
of
almost
goats.
like, yeah, it's, but he doesn't even want to go in. He doesn't, and he's like, he's not scared of goats, but he's like, so if all the three dogs come like running out, he gets overwhelmed, you know, but, so you have to, you know, let them out one at a time. Or yeah, like if he came into the clinic room with three dogs in here, he'd get really quickly overwhelmed, but then can't regulate. So like does things to set the dogs, like throws the toys and stuff, which sets the dogs into that higher arousal, but then he freaks out about the dogs being this higher arousal. And I'm like, okay, dogs, everybody stop. Everyone just stop. Yeah, and I tried horses, and I'd, so it's like, and it also was terrified of chickens, terrified of cats, scared of horses, just likes dogs but overwhelmed by the number of dogs. And so I'd like tried all this, you know, management of the environment and things like that. And since the goats situation, we've now been able, like now I can let all three dogs out and we can handle that.
Wow.
My cat's following this kid around everywhere, which he used to scream if he saw the cat come out of wherever. Doesn't scream and run away from the chickens anymore, like can handle the chickens, like bizarre. But I reckon it's, I'm just making this up obviously, I don't know, but I reckon it's something to do with like finding that one safe space, which was in the goat pen, but being in there with me and his mum, and then being able to, transfer sort of like that feeling or that settledness, or like really actually finally be able to build a relationship maybe with him, because he was always on edge, even though like I would have no animal, like I don't want people to listen to this being like, well, Sam, that's because you terrorized him with animals every session. That's not what I had no animals around. Like I had, you know, like I wasn't doing animal stuff because he was scared of them. So, yeah, like, and I tried like, you know, just small amounts of whatever to, yeah, anyway. But yeah, so I wonder if it's, you know, actually finally being able to finding something that he enjoyed, which also is a common interest because they're my goats and you love goats. And so now we have this in common. And if we've built a relationship off of that, and then we've been able to transition that out of the goat paddock, and now we've been able to, so he's picked a favorite horse, which is Thunderstorm, who is the worst behaved horse on this farm. Like he's so naughty because he's a Brumby that was born domestic. So he's got all the Brumby genetics with none of the survival instinct. None of the, like he hasn't ever lived in the wild and it shows. So he, like he's pushy, you know, he's lovely, but he's just pushy and just, yeah, he's just got no regard. Like he try, if I go in the paddock, he tries to scratch his entire side of his body just rubbing up against me. And I'm like going flying across. I'm like, what are you doing? Can't do that. Don't do that. I have to be really careful who I put him with. If I put him with clients, it has to be with someone that knows horses or whatever. Anyway, so, and he's 3 years old, so he's just really at that age. That's his favorite horse, apparently. And I'm like, okay. And I'm make jokes about how, well, that makes sense because he's the naughtiest horse that we have here. So, but he loves that for some reason.
Yeah. That's so funny.
Isn't that interesting? Strange.
Tell me about the goats.
Must be, but it, I don't know, like, because he doesn't, it's not like he's obsessed with the goats. Like, he doesn't need to go in there. But what's that about? Like, why does he not need to go in there? Why doesn't he doesn't even want to go in there? Like, he's just, I don't know. What's that about? I don't understand that at all. But it's, and he's, like, still obviously got a lot of challenges in his day-to-day life, but doing well. Like,
so good, actually though.
Quite well. Isn't that, yeah, interesting. But It's just another like little thing to remember about like the dependency thing of, yeah, but I don't actually think that having a relationship with the goats themselves was going to help anything. I don't actually think that's what it is. I think the goats are a vessel, a tool, an object. Sorry, animal welfare people, if you're ripping your hair out, calm down. I'm just talking about clinically speaking. Mean that the goats are objects. I love them very much. But yeah, if there's some kind of tool or something that helps us to build the relationship, because that's ultimately what our job is and where the benefit's gonna come from. But yeah, we just need that something else. Some people, some clients just need that something else to build, get that relationship building. I don't know.
I agree.
Maddie, what do you think are like the most like relied upon activities that you do with Maple, particularly like we're talking about dependency, like when you've got new clients or clients where you're really wanting to facilitate that bond?
Yeah.
Are they your go-tos? I mean, you said the bubbles.
Yeah. So like she eats bubbles, and then obviously a lot of the clients go, I wonder what they taste like. I'm going to try them.
Right.
And I say, oh, maybe don't. It would be quite soapy. I'm like, you can try one, but don't, like, she bites quite a lot, so like maybe not all of them. Bubbles, I do like their engine speeds and the zones. I find the food puzzles fun because they get to see like how her brain works and how she's so smart, because they think like, how would she ever know that there's food under there? I've got that this one because I
is that a medicine one?
Yeah, good.
Oh, they're so good.
So like that's a fun one to do. Just showing them that like she can sit and she can lay and she can shake hands and things like that. Like that's fun for them, especially when they tell her to do it, and then they feel like they're so powerful because they've like they think they've taught her to do these things. Which is very cute. She likes to sit up on my chair, which is funny for a lot of kids because then she's like the therapist.
Kids love it when Nala steals my chair. If I get up and do something, get up to get something and Nala jumps on my chair, kids love that. They think it's love so it. Funny.
Yeah, they're like, ah, like, cute. I'm like, oh, you don't need me anymore. And like, they think that's really funny. just like patting her, like looking at photos even, like before they meet her to get some sort of like relationship built. Before that, treats. I've got like different bandanas. Like I have Pablo and Co. various bandanas. So I can ask the kids like, should we pick what one we're going to put on her for the day? So there's like a peanut butter one, and there's like a lolly one, and like it, I don't know, gives them some choice in it. They always love choosing that. Whether she has one on, they're like, oh, let's change that. Playing with her ball. Talking about her favorite things, talking about their favorite things, just getting to know her a little bit. And just patting her, like feeling how soft her ears are, or I don't know, why, just asking questions about her. Kids love to do that, get to know her a little bit more. But I find, bubbles and treats, the food puzzle, are the things I use the most, because they get to interact with her a little bit, as well as her warming up to them as well at the same time, because then she knows that they're fun. They're trustworthy.
Do you,
every time they come in.
Do you have, like, when you take on a new client,
yeah,
is she in the room for that first session, or do you?
I try not to. I was doing it at the start because a lot of the time when people book, because they can see on the website that Maple comes with me basically. So at the start she was in there, but then I was finding that it was getting too distracting trying to do an intake session with the parent and then the child wanting to play with the dog, but I wanted to get as much information as possible.
Especially if there's siblings there.
Yeah, and it was just like a bit too chaotic. So I found like intake setting the expectation that she won't be there. And that if she was there next time, that's great. If she's not, then she might be there the time after. But intakes and assessments, obviously not having her there for the purpose of being able to get the information and actually do like that side of the job really well without getting sidetracked with the dog, because it's very easy to do that.
That makes a lot of sense. Do you have like photos of Maple that like in that first session where you're like, this is going to be, this is how we interact with Maple? Or do you do that for the first session that she's in the room?
I definitely show them photos of her. I say, oh, they obviously see the crate as well, and they see all the dog stuff, and they're like, what's that for?
Curious.
I'm like, well, it's not for the kids, is it?
The naughty kids.
Yeah. With the older ones, I'm like, oh, I lock kids in there. And then the younger ones, I don't say that because they might actually be scared.
I would have been the type of kid to believe that.
Yeah. I pick the kids that I tell that to, but I show photos, and then I've also got like up on my wall near her crate is like the dog's like body signals poster. And then like the dog's feeling wheel as well. And when we meet her for the first time, yeah, like setting all those ground rules and expectations and kind of saying that if she's walked into her crate on her own, like that's her space. We don't bother her in her space. We can get her out, but we're not going to poke fingers and heads in there and annoy her when she's sleeping. And just obviously like doing the zones and things like that as a first almost activity to know that like if we get her into red zone, like we don't really want to see that, like she's crazy, like she could accidentally scratch you, she could jump on you, like that will hurt, she's quite a big dog, and just knowing it's funny and fun as it would be to get her going nuts, the size of the room and the size of you as like a 5-year-old child, probably not the best thing to get her like off her head running around zooming around, and it's kind of good just letting them know that like there's times and places that she can do that, and that's great. But in this little room, it's like big, but it's not, she can't zoom in it. Like if she was to do that, she would be taking things out. She's not huge, but she's like almost 30 kilos, which is big enough.
Yeah, absolutely. With kids especially as well.
Yeah, with kids. Yeah. Like teenagers.
In a confined space.
Yeah. I'm like, if we want to do that, like we can take her, like we have a courtyard space outside. I'm like, if we want to see how high she can jump, which is high, like we can take her out there.
Yeah.
But not in here.
Yeah.
Not right.
Yeah. I'm just making some notes. So do you want to explain to people a little bit about zones and how you do that and what that's for?
Just yeah, brief, actually,
just sort of briefly, yeah.
Oh, I was going to get a picture, but...
Yeah, get it.
Yeah, get it.
That'd be cute.
All right, so got the zones of regulation. It's obviously backwards, but...
Oh, it's so cute.
I've got blue, green, so cute. Yellow, and red. So it's used in a lot of schools. I don't know whether it's also in Queensland, but a lot of the New South Wales schools use the zones of regulation. I like it and don't like it because I like it because... it can be good as a way for kids to understand how they're feeling and describe what they're feeling. But then a lot of kids think red zone's like the bad zone or like that's when they're naughty. So like blue zone's like sad, sick, tired, bored, like moving slowly. So that's kind of like that real low energy speed. Green's happy, calm, learning, switched on. Yellow is like a bit silly, but then it also can be like frustrated about losing some control. And then the way that the zones of regulation explain red zones, like mad, angry, terrified, yelling, hitting, out of control, or elated, which is fine. But like I have her like zooming around with the toy that I've like screenshotted from her video. So initially we go through that in terms of like, this is what Maple zones are. What zone do you think she is in right now? How do you think we could get her? Because if she's in blue zone, like she's tired, she's fast asleep, how could we get her to be able to be in that green zone where she's listening to us and she's switched on? That might be giving her some treats, asking her to shake, drop, whatever that is. Yellow could be starting to rile her up a little bit, throwing some toys for her, getting her to jump, blowing those bubbles. And then I explain what red zone would look like. But I said that could be the same as when you're at a park and your mum's yelling out to you and you're not able to listen because you're going too quick and your brain's not able to listen. So I said it can be fun for Maple to be in that zone, but it can be also unsafe if she's at the beach and she's pinning it for something and I've yelled for her name and she's not going to come back to me. That can be very unsafe. Doing that for Maple and then doing it for either myself as well, if they still don't really want to do it for them, and then doing it for their own zones, I find really good, because if you straight away go, what are your zones and let's draw pictures and stuff, they don't want to borrow it, do it for the dog, immediately they're like, I'll do mine.
Literally.
Yeah. And even like a lot of the kids that don't ever meet Maple, I still do it for her. Like, I have a dog, Maple, blah, blah, blah. Do that example, do theirs, they're happy to do it. And then I also, yeah, did the engine speed. So like, rather than have set like blocks, have like almost like a car engine that like goes from like slow up to fast.
That's cute.
Again, with pictures of her, because kids love anything that's not them. Mm-hmm. But almost rather than like describing red as like the bad zone, have it as like you're just going really quickly, like your brain, your body, everything is going really fast. It's hard. And then I do like a car engine first. So where can you drive slow, on speed and fast, like highway, school zones, whatever. I do Maples and just say, how could we get her to be a bit faster, a bit slower, depending on what we want her to do. And then I do it for them as well. And I find those two tools I do with pretty much everyone, say under the age of 10.
Mm-hmm.
A bit older, I can like talk about it, but they don't really want to like sit down and draw pictures of their speeds or their zones. But I like the speed a bit better, because it's a bit, it takes away the fact that like red is bad and you shouldn't get in red zone at all, because red zone can be okay, but it just means that to slow down will be harder for you. And if you're not in the right environment for that speed, that's where you might get into a little bit of trouble.
I love that. I absolutely love that.
Yeah.
Because teachers and OTs and that, they're all using colours for stuff as well.
Yes.
And they use it for feelings and stuff. I really love zones of regulation, because it makes a lot of sense to me. Like, this makes sense. You just in the high arousal state, basically. But it is complex. Like, older kids can understand and separate. Well, my teachers used red for angry, but in this situation, we're using red for the arousal is out of control state.
Yes.
But yeah, younger kids, like, they just get overwhelmed and confused, but everyone's using colors for stuff. And they're already, and especially if the teacher's got a color system already in the classroom, they're seeing that every day. So it can then be really tricky to try and introduce the colors meaning something different. But yeah, the engine, it's pretty universal, really.
Yeah. And I just find that like red means stop, red is like a red light on a sign. A lot of them mean to stop, or to like that thing is like not the right thing, or like a thumbs up is green and a thumbs down is red. Like, there's so many, like you said, Sam, like color systems that are already in place, and then you try to do zones.
Yeah.
And even some parents that have done it with someone else go, oh, don't go into the red zone. Like, it's a bad place you don't want to go, but you can go there. Like, it's fun. Mm. Like, everyone does it, where you might just get that little bit too fast and a little bit too crazy, but know how to come back down or just know the right place, right time. So there are two things that, yeah, I do a lot. And like I said, don't have to even have Maple here to do them, because every kid likes to do something that's not them. You could do cartoon characters even if you didn't have a dog, I reckon.
Yeah,
definitely. Just to take it away from them and not have it so.
Oh, that's what people do. They use super flex stuff and things like that. Using other characters. And we've done that, like, it's in the books and all that sort of stuff, which I still use that stuff. I just then talk about like, or you know, Nala's, you know, what wakes up Nala's red beast, stuff like that. First. Yeah. Okay, so that's the zones and the edge and speed. So what types of things might bubbles be useful for? So I know that engaging the dog and developing some human-animal bond play is sometimes useful as well, can be quite useful. What else do you think could be?
I really like doing it for breathing.
Yeah.
So like doing bubble breathing, encouraging like that really like deep and slow exhale, you get more bigger bubbles for Maple to pop, as opposed to like that shallow breathing that doesn't actually end up with too many bubbles. Better than just sitting there and going, let's breathe on the count of four or whatever the breathing style is. I find that a lot better, because then it can be like, well, Maple really wants to pop these bubbles. We've got to make as many as we can. And doing that really practice breathing is good. I've also done it like blowing our worries like into the bubbles, and then like when Maple eats them, like she's eating your worries.
Love that.
Can be cute as well. So yeah, obviously play is fun, but then I like to, if they always gravitate towards the bubbles, I go, oh, let's do some breathing while we're doing this as well. Otherwise, like we're spending 5 minutes blowing bubbles. Yeah, it's fun for the dog and it's fun for the child, but I don't want you to go out to your parent and be like, we just blew bubbles the whole time. Nothing else.
They're going to say that anyway. Yeah. Do you know how, like, so many kids, Max, cannot blow bubbles to save their lives? Cannot blow bubbles to save their lives. Like, it takes quite a lot of actual like breath control, but it's so eye-opening as like an observation thing to be like, oh my God, like you'd be like, okay, gently. And they're like, and I'm like, what are you doing? And they're like, I don't know, like 8 years old. And you're like, what is happening? No wonder this kid can't do the deep breathing and the whatever, because Lord help them if they can control. Yeah, like what is happening? So then, yeah, it becomes a really useful, like,
I use like the big stick.
I use that one too. It's so much easier for them.
50 cents from Kmart.
Yeah.
And then also teaching them that, like, when they pull it up, not to just like fling the stick out and like the bubble mix goes everywhere.
What about when they get distracted blowing their bubble and they just tip the whole thing out?
That's the worst.
And I'm like, okay.
No.
That's the end of the bubbles.
And then
they're so cheap. And it's the best bubble mix. I've even taken that bubble mix, bought those, and put that bubble mix into smaller bubble things as well, because it's the best bubble mix.
Yeah, so I like doing that. Because I don't like sitting there and doing breathing. So I'm like, how can I teach that?
Yeah, exactly. It's boring as an adult. So
I hate it.
So I'm like, how can I make this fun for everyone, including myself?
Literally.
Yeah.
Cute. I do the eating the worries as the bubbles thing too. Cute. But I don't tell the kids that that's what's going to happen. So only Oliver eats the bubbles, so I can only do it with him. Nala doesn't care. But I'll just be like, okay, so just want to imagine, take a deep breath and just blow all your worries away, the bubbles. And so they're like, hopefully, blow the bubbles. And then hilariously, Oliver loses his mind and has to like jump up and snap all these bubbles. And the kids are then hysterical with like, because it's chaos, and the kids think it's hilarious. The dogs lost the plot completely, and the kids losing their mind like with how funny it is. And then I do the whole like, what is he doing? What's he doing with your worries? And they're like, But then you can transfer that. So this is why I have like the little bubble things. So you can buy them in bulk off like eBay, little party bubble things.
Oh yeah.
And then we transition them home, but I don't like the bubble mix that's in them and they're hard to use. So I tip that out and put the Kmart wand bubble mix in them. Pro tip.
Good hack. Yeah.
So then you can transition that. We've given the bubbles for home so that if they have, you know, bad day at school or whatever, they can blow the worries out, but hopefully it's going to be associated with that hilarious little moment that happened in the session where it was so funny and crazy and cute when Oliver ate all their worries, trying to like develop like an association with that activity of like blowing the worries out with the bubbles, you know?
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Cute.
Okay, so what about your use of puzzles? Because I use puzzles for like a million different intervention ideas. Could do, I've said this to you before, Max, we could do it in a podcast entirely on puzzles. What are some of your favorites, Maddie?
I've honestly just only started using it as like a fun thing for the child to do with Maple. I've also been like trying to think of like ways to integrate it into an actual activity for the child to learn. So I'm interested to know what you do. But I also just tell them, like, the way Maple learns is, like, through her nose and watching her brain try to figure out things is fun. Try not to help her. She needs to figure it out on her own. Sometimes when we're learning new things, blah, blah, like, do that kind of thing. But I haven't really thought of any other ways to apply it. And I have another puzzle at home that I haven't bought in yet, but it's another one of the Nina Ottison ones that, like, kind of spins, like, at the bone shape. And it has the different, like, levels.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it spins. But haven't bought that one in yet.
I think I've got that one too.
It's like blue and yellow.
I bought a few new ones that are like a bit better because I've got like flipping maybe 15 puzzles at the office. Because Kmart does some really cheap ones. Sometimes I let kids do like, so I will do some self-directed like play that turns into learning. And they go through it and they do like all the puzzles. So in that process, depending on like the kid and what goals they have and what difficulties, you know, that already that they've got, it's like you can, there is like a million like narrative and metaphor sort of learning pathways mm-hmm. that you can take from the puzzle stuff. So for example, like a kid that's giving like a million puzzles, they can start to sort them into order of difficulty because some of them are really easy and some of them are harder. And then we can talk about like, why would we do that? Like, why would we do the easy ones first? What does that do? And then I can explain to them like the process of learning and being like having a confidence built. Mm. Whereas, you know, having a really tricky, so if you start with the hardest one, and scale it back, I don't know, how would that feel? Like, because if they can't do the hard one and then you have to keep going back, or if they can do the hard one but have to keep going back in difficulty, wonder what that's like. And then you could mold that based on that kid's experience at school. So if you've got a really sensitive kid who has learning issues, and they get given the same work as everyone else, but then they can't do it. So then they get given different work that's supposed to be easier and easier and easier. How does that make them feel for that? Like, we just forget that children are human beings.
Mm.
How would that make you feel if that's how that was handled for you as a person, that you got given the work that everyone else did and it was too hard and then you had to get it scaled back? Until it finally got to a level that you can kind of do it.
That's horrible.
That's horrible. Mm-hmm. Versus if we start here at a level that you can do it. So that's shattering, right? To be given the hard one and go backwards. But if we start here at the easy one, how does that make you feel? Like, oh, well, that's confidence building. Mm-hmm. Like that actually builds you as you're on that pathway and journey to do that. So all these kids that we've got with learning difficulties that go either into high school or whatever, and they've got teachers or whoever who haven't noticed on their one school that they're doing grade 4 work and they've been given grade 9 work just so that this kid can sit there and be like, oh, okay, so I don't know shit and I feel like an idiot. Like, great.
Yeah.
You know, it's actually pretty easy to understand why they get so avoidant of school and they get so anxious and have those self-esteem issues. But it's cool to like play it out that way with the puzzles and the dog and stuff like that, to be like, well, yeah, like how would that make them feel? Or if we give them like you've got a kid that does really well but they're getting bored at school because it's too easy, then you can kind of recreate that as well. Like the easy puzzles that the dogs do, it takes like 1 second for them to get the treats out of it. Like they're not even really puzzles, like they're just nothingness, you know. Even Kiki, like she can do, I've got the noughts and crosses one from Kmart, the plastic one, that's, I've had that here for a bit, and I put treats in it and gave it to her and she just, it took her like, I don't know, 1 minute and she just got everything, all the treats out. She was just like sliding the things and I was like, oh, okay.
Okay, this meant to last
you
longer.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to get you a different activity to entertain you for more than 1 minute, damn it.
It's almost like not knowing how to do things, blah, blah, blah. Some kids that are like, Maple, roll over. And she can't roll over. Like, she doesn't know how.
Yeah.
And they're like, roll over, roll. Like, they've said like 5 times. And I'm like, I have to explain, Maple doesn't know how to roll over. How would you feel if I asked you to do a backflip? And they're like, I can't do a backflip. I'm like, yeah, but if I asked you like five times now, like do a backflip, do a backflip.
Yeah.
Like, how would that? And they're like, oh, well, that would feel bad because I don't know how to do it. And that would make me feel annoyed.
Yeah,
I'm like,
absolutely.
Well, and then you go to the whole point of like, if your parents are asking you to do something or school's asking you to do something that you don't know how to do, that's upsetting and that's frustrating and blah, blah, blah. But it kind of works out good that she doesn't know how. She's just one of those dogs that's like quite stiff and doesn't want to roll as
Yeah,
much
my
as I
dogs
try
don't
to
roll over.
lure her over.
Yeah,
Like, I want her to be able to do it, but I'm like, it's
I
not for
tried
you.
too. My dogs don't do
Dougie
it.
hates it. Yeah, he could do
Yeah.
it as a puppy, and then he got to a point where it's not comfortable.
I think when they're floppy, it's
Like,
easy because they can just flop over.
Like you say, Maddie, thank God that the dogs don't know what it is, because they would be having to roll over 100 times a day because kids just keep asking them to roll over. I'm like, thank God they don't know what that is.
Yeah, honestly.
Yeah, so frustration tolerance. So I do like to use puzzles for that as well. So understanding like that, you know, the process of learning it can be frustrating and all those sorts of things, that whole pathway. The impulse control when the dog has to wait for the activity to get set up, you know, patience and things like that. Teamwork, working collaboratively, planning. So I like to, you know, we'll making a bit of a plan about this activity and how it's going to go and things like that. The social skill of setting up. So I get kids that set up the puzzle. They're really keen. They want to do the puzzle. They set up the puzzle and then they give it to the dog and then the kid just walks off while the dog does the puzzle. And I'm like, all right, mate, like, how dare you not delight in Oliver while he's masterminding this puzzle? You savage. How dare you be so cute and smart. But it is one of those social skills where it's like, well, my part's done, so I'm not interested in. And that's actually something to learn, is like to delight in the other person in the future, but in this case it's a dog. But delight in their experience. Like, you can actually share this experience with them, even though you're not physically doing the puzzle. That's one of the reactions that I get, where they just are totally disinterested, which is it's crazy to me how motivated the kid can be to do set up the puzzle. Like, I really want to do the puzzle. And then they don't even watch the dog do it. And I'm like, what? It's obviously the best part. Yeah, what are you doing? The other reaction is the kids that are like helping the dog, like they want to do the puzzle sort of for them.
Yes.
And then we can have that conversation around, you know, what the roles. So like, but your role in this game is this part. So now you're also doing the finding the treats. So which part is Oliver's part? If you're, because your Oliver isn't doing the setting up part, so now he's not really doing the other part either.
Yeah, like, is it fair?
He's not getting a turn. Yeah, like, that's not really turn taking, which is hard because the kids are impulsive and they just really want to get him out. One thing that I've got is that I see as well, is almost like a proprioceptive issue, where kids will be like, they get in the way of the dogs, like their body's just in the way of the dog because the dog's got to move around the puzzle a lot of the time, and the kids are just like in the way, or they put the puzzle like in a really difficult spot, like there's no room for the dog to work the puzzle. So I think that's a really interesting theory of mind and insight building sort of thing as well, around like, you know, what do we think about the space that the puzzle's in right now? Like, I like to ask questions like that. Like, what do we think about where the puzzle is? And then they actually, like, they pause and then they look around and realize, oh, I've put the puzzle like in this corner under a coffee table and the dog can't really get to it. So things like that, like just really aware of the dog, being aware of the dog's experience as someone that's not you. So coming out of you and that perspective taking and things like that, which is super important, super, super important. The other thing I work on a lot, it was just on the tip of my tongue, help seeking. So those times when the kids are trying to do the puzzle for the dog, I'll talk about like asking for help and, you know, how do we know when the dog needs help? So, and the dogs will usually stop and they'll look at you for guidance on, can you please refill the puzzle? I'm finished. Or they look at you for like, I'm stuck. Like I'm actually, so teaching about, it's okay to help because I don't want them to feel like they can't be helpful, but it's actually really important to either ask someone if they need help or wait for them to ask you for help before we just rush in and help them, because it's a really common part of the ASD profile is that nurturing and helpfulness, but sometimes it's very overbearing and we're just doing thing because we just love being helpful so much. That's just such a like a task, helping task thing is just so fulfilling and enjoyable, but the people that we're like we're kind of becoming overbearing in the relationships when we're doing that, so and then people are avoiding us and things like that because we're actually taking away from their experiences. So teaching kids even just a simple social skill of asking, you know, do you want me to help you? A lot of the time, especially siblings in siblings relationships, a lot of the time the other kid's going to be like, no, I do it myself, you know?
Yeah.
So that's a really important. Otherwise, these kids just steamroll in and take over.
Yeah. Yeah.
So teaching, like my dogs have pretty obvious help, asking for help stuff. So I find that one really useful to teach for some kids as well. Lots of things, lots of things.
Yeah, now that you mentioned that, like they're all things that I would have already seen.
Yeah.
But it's actually picking up on it and really dragging it out into a learning experience rather than really like commenting on it, but not actually going into how that is in their actual life and not just in this tiny relationship in here.
Yeah, and I think we can sometimes get, I've seen people get a bit caught up on like explaining away the situation. So like jumping in and sort of just explaining the situation to this kid or client rather than using the situation as a learning opportunity by asking the client to explain it. It's just such a tiny little difference to make. But the more that you talk over things, the less you're going to find out about what your client knows and is experiencing.
Yeah.
Especially a lot of clients have got that kind of either perfectionist profile stuff or people pleasing or avoidance or any of those kinds of traits that are going to keep them for just, they're just going to agree with you and then parrot what you've said. So it's like, I've got a lot of clients that are like that. So I try to not say very much at all until I feel like I have a bit of a clearer idea of what's going on for them and what they're thinking and feeling and all that sort of stuff. So, but definitely these situations with the dog, I don't know. I think people get a bit, well, I do it. So I do it in certain situations. Here's where I do it. I used to do it a lot when I was back in the early days, 10 years ago. But nowadays I do it when this is not a client. So I can feel the difference between like a waiting room interaction with not a client or like interactions that my dogs will have people with not a client, and they'll say something about the dog, what the dog's doing, and I'll just explain what the dog's doing, or I'll just tell them what the dog's doing. But with a client, in a client session, I try to make it useful by having the client have more of an input on what, or I like ask questions about what they can see or whatever, just to try and make it into something that they can actually learn from for them. It's like more relatable to them that way. Whereas if I just explain, this is what the dog's doing, that's kind of like a bit of a dead end in the conversation a lot of the time, not all the time, but a lot of the time.
Yeah. Agree.
Okay. So the other thing you had was, Maple's favorite things. I do a bit of this as well. I use that for like developing bond, finding common interests, things like that. And I also do favorite things. I've done favorite things with all of my dogs and shown kids, like, so they're siblings, some of their favorite things are the same as each other and some of them are different. Yeah. So sometimes they can play with each other doing the things that they both like, but when they want to do these other things, they're probably not gonna do that together.
Yeah,
because they don't like both like it. So, you know, but if they were best friends, they probably might make an effort to do that other thing that
for the other part, the other dog. Yeah.
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 Well, so what do you mean by that? Like favorite activities, or do you also mean like toys or
everything?
Like everything. Yeah. Just stuff. Like whatever the favorite.
Like favorite food, favorite places, favorite things to chase. Favorite places to be scratched, like lots, like you can do anything really, but then trying to think of things that also kids would like.
Yeah, so okay, like, so they can relate to it,
like cuddles with me, and then they're like, oh well, I like cuddles with my mom.
Or
it's like Maple really likes the beach, or I like going to the beach, but then it could be like Ollie really likes swimming in the ocean, but Maple doesn't really know how to be in the way, so she just like kicks and tries to eat the water. So like they're not the best. Like he's like Ollie can swim good. She's swallows too much water and then throws it up. She's getting better, but she's just he's like a little sea otter and then she's just chaos. But just finding things that kids could also like, she likes peanut butter or cheese or whatever the thing is, and it's like, oh, I like cheese too.
When you do like a first session with kids, it's good to get like their interests and stuff, like, and try
so
and
that's
find,
how you get them talking.
So it'll be things like, you know, like can be interests, hobbies, but favorite, like you can get, like there's all these worksheets you can download, but it's like your favorite food, movie, whatever, things like that. But it's really just to get them and get an idea of, like, get to know them, you know.
I suppose that helps with planning like future sessions too, right? Like, because then you can kind of get a sense of what they're more likely to participate in.
Definitely.
Based on that
special
stuff?
Yeah, if they've got special interests, definitely. You're going to want to make use of, or like, so I find out that kids are playing soccer, doesn't take me long before I'm using a red card analogy. Like, you know, going to get carded, bro. Going to get carded for that kind of thing.
Thanks so much, Maddie, for
coming on. It's fun to chat. I like talking about this kind of thing. Super fun having in this chat.
Thanks, Maddie.
Thank you, Maddie.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you're interested in studying with Therapy Dogs Australia, or you have a few more questions before deciding, please get in touch with us by emailing courses@therapydog.com.au or visiting our website at www.therapydog.com.au for more information and FAQs.